I'm not going to have a death match, but I'm going to do some dumb shit. Like, I'm going to have a Mick Foley match.
Oh, that'll be good with your neck and everything.
I know. That's why I'm stressing out, because I've been planning this shit for 6 months. Like, this is my big event. Like, this is my fucking... I think I told you about it. We do it for those rehab kids or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like the craziest fucking crowd you've ever even thought of being in front of. Like, last year, give you an example, I went up for a 10-count punch, just a regular-ass fucking bang. It's in every match ever.
Mm-hmm.
And these assholes started a suck-his-dick chant. So these are my children. These are the people that I want to do something in front of. But, I, you know, I've already bought the fucking thumbtacks. And fucking, we've got all the a copious amount of plunder. Like, that's the thing. Like, the one thing that...
Montgomery and Joe Kaczynski, how you guys doing?
What's going on, man?
Nah, I'm pretty good, guys. Pretty good.
Court, what happened to your neck last week? Explain it a little bit. We talked about it when you were gone, but...
Well, I still haven't seen the footage. It hasn't come out yet. But, yeah, I was in the middle of a 6-man tag last weekend, and I made the hot tag to my tag partner. Well, when he came in and hit one of the guys, somehow the guy flew halfway across the ring and landed directly on my fucking neck. So, yeah, so doctors don't know what the fuck's going on. I stayed in the emergency room for like 5-6 hours at night. Going back to the doctor again this week. I still got a big fucking show this weekend, so whatever. I'll just get through it.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the show that you're promoting this weekend.
Oh, well, it's a private event that we do every year for this program called the Insight Program. What that is, it's a rehab facility for young adults. They have facilities in Greensboro, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, and in Atlanta, Georgia. And I believe they just recently opened one up in Raleigh. You know, they get plans to open them up all over the place. But anyway, like I said, it's a rehab facility for young adults, roughly ages like 13 to 26. And this is my first year promoting one, but we do a big thing called Sober Slam for them every year. And it's just, they are the wildest bunch of kids I've ever wrestled in front of in my life. It's the closest thing to like an, it's like if ECW, PWG, and like Hood Slam had a weird fucked up baby, that would be this crowd. And it's just the coolest shit, man. You know, if you look up Sober Slam on YouTube, you can find footage from the previous years where the other guy was promoting it. I've been a part of it every year. But this is the first time it's kind of been in my baby, you know. And I'm hoping to work with them more in the future and have one. So because like I said, this is private just for the kids from all the programs coming together. It's like one of their one big things they get to do every year. Just kind of an escape for the kids, you know. I'm hoping that later this year we do one where we can sell tickets and raise money for the program because it's such a great facility, such a great program in general. You know, they've really taken me in as part of the family. You know, it's really nice to be a part of something that's positive for somebody. You know, because I'm a big negative bastard. You know, but mm-hmm. it's really nice to be involved in something like this and. I really treat this, and I know it's kind of cliche to say, but I treat this show as my WrestleMania every year. And this is the show that I look forward to because it's just, and I'm not the only one. It's a lot of the guys, you know, in this area that really look forward to it. So, you know, we're hoping to do something special with it this year. I've got some really, really dumb shit planned.
So you guys don't sell, like videotape copies of this or DVDs or anything like that?
As of right now, no, but I actually have a full-blown camera crew coming this year, so I'm hoping to sell DVDs. I'm not going to go ahead and guarantee that. It may be something I release for free on the internet, you know, but it's the goal is to have a DVD product come out of it this year and having some of the proceeds go and help, you know, with the program and stuff like that. It's kind of baby steps, you know. We've got an idea in our head of what we want to do with it. You know, we don't want to water it down because this is their once-a-year thing. You know, it's just like anything. You know, you do it, the more often you do it, the less exciting it is. So we don't know exactly what the deal is, but we're hoping, you know, this year is going to be a lot different with me in charge because I'm having, like I said, some professional photographers coming in, full-blown camera crew. Production level is going to be completely different. Like, I'm really trying to have this as, like, a big event, you know, something real special that we can show the world because all the other stuff in previous years, it's been kind of like low budget, kind of some people just with the camcorder, or, you know, it's not the best quality. Like I said, you can find it all over YouTube, and it's okay quality, but it's not what I would want. I would never release it for money. Yeah, this is this Saturday, July 1st. Man, and if I can think of it too, I'll post up some pictures and stuff, you know, on the page, kind of let everybody see the craziness that is it. And then if we do have a big DVD release, you know, I'll make sure it's, we'll let everybody know. But like I said, it's all for a great cause, guys. It's one of the coolest things I've ever been a part of.
Yeah, Court cares about the kids.
I sure as shit don't care about myself, so I gotta care about somebody.
He's kind of like Trick Daddy.
What the fuck?
Trick loves the kids.
It's episode 9 and we sunk into a Trick Daddy comment.
No one's listening. This doesn't matter.
That's all right. I almost busted out a Lenny Poffo limerick here before we get started with the King of the Ring.
Oh, God. That's right. We are talking about the fucking King of the Ring today, aren't we?
Yes, we are. It's all Joey's fault. He decided that we needed to watch this show today, over the last week. So
well,
we suffered through this for everyone.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
Through a little peek behind the curtain, I suggested we did a King of the Ring for the month of July. I said 93, 94, 95. Court suggested to go with 95.
Now, let me tell everybody why.
Because 95 is our thing.
Well, not even necessarily 95 is our thing, but bad wrestling is our thing.
Well, that's true too.
So, like, why, I didn't want to bore anybody with us talking about how much we like wrestling. I'd much rather just shit on things.
Well, there's plenty to shit on in this show. It is horrible.
Yes. I'll say out of you know both podcasts that I do, all the previous shit that we've tried to cover in the past, and what it says about this show. This is the least amount of notes I have ever taken.
This show reminds me of this Lenny Poffo genius poem I heard him once say. And that is, violets are blue, roses are red. Oh boy, guys, I'm about to give myself some head because this thing sucks so much dick.
Wow.
You don't remember when he did that?
Well, good night, folks. That's the end of the episode.
All right, so I guess
wow.
We should, just on that note, start this fucking thing. Some notes before, the network version of this was from the Coliseum Home video release, which I found odd because if you can release this and it was a Coliseum Home video release, why can't you release the actual, like, Coliseum Home video exclusives on the network? Those would be things I would love to watch and review, unlike this show. So I thought that was
weird. Well, there's certain pay-per-views that are like that, I've noticed, too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because around this era, you know, they didn't have the limits of the videotape, so you know, they knew their pay-per-views were going to be about 2.5-ish hours or whatever. So if you go back and look at, like, say, King of the Ring 93 is actually another good example. There's tons of Coliseum exclusives because you don't miss a single thing off the pay-per-views. It's still the live pay-per-view, basically, just with extra bonuses. So, yeah, but I agree with you, because there's, I own tons of Coliseum videos. Like, one of my favorite ones was one called Bloopers, Bleeps, and Body Slams.
Yep.
So, like, it would be nice if they started releasing stuff like that, and just all those random house shows and fucking, you know, Stars Dark matches that no one saw.
Yeah, it would be nice. This was also the first pay-per-view in Philadelphia since the 90s SummerSlam. And it may be the reason why the crowd stayed as hot as it did for so long. I was kind of surprised going back and watching this how into it they were, as bad as the show was. I mean, they kind of turned about halfway through, but they stuck it out for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really notice anything really differently as far as, like, it being in Philadelphia until, you know, like you said, halfway through, then you start getting the ECW chants. And then I was like, ah, yeah, this is the Philadelphia crowd. But in, yeah, that is odd that they wouldn't go. They weren't there for 5 years, for at least a major pay per view.
And
it's one of those things where I'm sure they had reasons, but I mean, they kind of skipped around a lot back then, as far as like they would only stay in certain areas and wouldn't go to certain areas for a long time.
And speaking of ECW, this was right in the height of their kind of reign on the independent. '95 was like I would consider probably their strongest year creatively, and a lot of their famous fans were in the crowd. If you look camera side in the front row, a lot of the guys that were there were also at many of the ECW shows, so I found that kind of interesting.
Was that the Yahoos with the cowboy hat and the Hawaiian shirts?
Yep.
Okay. That's what I thought.
My very first note of this show was, hey, look, it's fucking Hat Guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
and we're going to do an ECW show at some point. Me and Court are huge ECW fans. It's kind of what brought us together. It's kind of how we met and kind of became friends, was over ECW. Joey is not so much an ECW fan, so that should be an interesting show for the future.
And it blows my mind, because me and Joey share our hate for the Attitude Era. And I remember when we brought up ECW, he's like, eh. I'm like, what the fuck, man? Like, I thought we had a thing here.
I like 94, 95, 96 ECW, but then it's like I started to trail off a little bit.
Well, it's like Gary said, creatively, that's the peak. But match quality-wise, ECW is much later on. But that's a whole other episode.
Right.
Did anyone notice that almost everyone in the crowd had the stupid blue King of the Ring shirts on?
Yeah, and I think even Shawn Michaels had like the blue King of the Ring hat when he came to the ring, so.
Yeah, I don't know if they were pushing the merchandise hard or what the fuck that was.
I was almost wondering if they gave them away. Like they do at baseball games, they have like shirt night or whatever. They were giving them as they came in the door. There was a ton of people with those stupid blue shirts on.
That, or they must have been fucking cheap, or I don't know. Probably, you're right. They probably gave them the fuck away. Maybe they made like way too many if they weren't selling enough. Because you gotta think, man, this is '95. Business was fucking down, so they're trying to do anything to make everybody happy.
Right.
And this is the very first year they were doing the monthly pay-per-view, so I'm wondering if they were running any sort of gimmick they could to get people in the buildings for monthly pay-per-views.
I didn't think about that. You're probably right. Like, you know, with this purchase, you'll get a free shirt or hat or fuck ever. Well, I know that I don't know about this one, but I know around this time, I remember when you ordered pay-per-views, they offered, you know, order pay-per-view and we'll send you this Shawn Michaels hat and gloves combo shit, you know.
Oh,
so
my God, that's right.
You're probably right on
forgot.
That.
I completely forgot they did that. You're right, so that's probably what it was. And to my knowledge, this is the only WWE pay-per-view that had no championship matches on it at all, which I have found bizarre, and it could have really used one.
Yeah, it really could have.
No, I agree with that.
And I know Diesel was hurt, and we'll talk about that when we get to the tag team main event, so they kind of hit him in that match. But Jeff Jarrett was fine. They had other guys that could have wrestled for title. I just didn't understand not having a title match on here.
Well, they still could have had a tag team title match. I mean, but then again, I don't know what tag teams were hot at that point. But yeah, they could have definitely had something.
Fucking Smoking Guns, anything, man. Had a fucking rematch from damn WrestleMania that year. But I digress.
I found it interesting as I was researching this. One of the Raws leading up to the pay-per-view, a particular rather famous wrestler, well, infamous now, had a tryout for the WWF. Chris Benoit had a tryout leading up to this and was offered a contract. Apparently, at the time, according to the sheets, Vince McMahon was very high on him. But Benoit turned the deal down because he didn't want to leave Japan.
That's wild. I didn't know that. I knew he was doing, like, house shows and stuff somewhere around this time, because there's at least a couple pictures that exist of him with DiBiase as his manager.
You kind of almost wonder where his career would have ended up if he would have came in 95 as opposed to when he did come in.
It's hard to say, you know, like, do you think if he comes into WWF, he laughs? Or do you think he's one of those that comes in, stays a little while, leaves for WCW anyway, you know? Like, it's hard to say.
He becomes a tag team partner with the 1-2-3 Kid.
It's hard. Yeah, it is hard to say because, honestly, what else did they have? I mean, they were running Mabel, Diesel, Sid at the top of the card. And Bret Hart, as we'll talk about later, some of the feuds he was stuck in 95. That would have been as good a chance as any, really, to kind of break in. I mean, there was not a whole lot on top in regards to talent. And I would have loved to have seen him against Razor in his prime, 1-2-3 Kid in his prime. A lot of those, there's Shawn Michaels. There's a lot of interesting matchups for Benoit in 95. Whether he had the character to kind of, it would have been interesting to see where he would have kind of landed. I don't know. But you would have also lost him all his matches in ECW, because he went to ECW shortly after this pay-per-view. He'd have lost his entire run in WCW. While it wasn't the greatest for him creatively, he had a lot of solid matches in WCW. And also, I mean, not to be morbid and talk about the deceased, would all of that have happened had he not went to ECW, had all those crazy matches where he's landing on his head, have all those matches in WCW where he's doing that flying headbutt on his head.
Well, at the same time, too, was he taking new, like, Japan dates, too? Because, you know, working that style, too, probably didn't help either.
Yeah, that's why he didn't take this offer, is he wanted to stay in Japan. So, right. I mean, they're working strong style then, too. So, it's hard to say. I mean, that's a big what if, but kind of can think about it, and maybe history takes a different route for him. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that because I watched a few of the Raws and then, you know, this pay-per-view. It's crazy to see how thin of a roster this is in 95. That you have Jerry Lawler working a little bit and things like that, but it just, I don't know, I guess I always just thought that, you know, the mid-90s they had tons of guys, especially going into 96, 97. But it's crazy, though, that, you know, if he would have probably came in, given the thinness of the roster, I mean, he probably could have secured himself a spot because, I mean, I don't think it would have been hard to beat out somebody like a Sparky Plug or a Roadie or something like that at this time.
All right. And the last little point I had here before we get into the show is there was the critical and commercial failure of this pay-per-view. It bombed on pay-per-view as well. Kind of led to the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon ladder match that they had at SummerSlam, because the original plans were for the Mabel and Diesel match to occur, but also for Razor and Psycho Sid to have a match. But they were so fearful of another pay-per-view bombing, especially one of their big four, SummerSlam, that they replaced Sid with Shawn Michaels and redid the ladder match from WrestleMania 10, which was probably a good choice, because other than that match and maybe that 1-2-3 Kid Hakushi match, it was a pretty dire pay-per-view in itself, as we've talked about on here many times before. So I think it was a good call on their part.
Well, before we get into this pay-per-view, what was the plan for Razor at SummerSlam 95 before they went with the ladder match?
Psycho Sid.
Well, I thought it was Shawn and Sid.
No, it was Razor and Sid.
Okay. Hmm. Well, I've been living a lie.
Well, what would surprise me, though, is that I guess Sid is at this time is considered a main event type guy, but I don't know. Like, I thought of Razor versus Sid, like, even if you didn't have Mabel versus Diesel, I still would have been kind of ew.
Yeah, and I think that kind of sums up this pay per view in general, is ew.
This fucking year.
Yeah, it's brutal. And this may be the worst pay per view of 95 for WWF, and that's saying something considering how awful the year was.
No, I flat out agree with you. It's got to be the fucking worst one. It's got to be.
Alright, so let's dive into this thing. So Razor Ramon was injured shortly before this pay-per-view happened, so they had a kind of scramble. For whatever reason, they decided to go with Savio Vega to kind of replace him, which I have no problems with Savio Vega. I don't know how familiar you guys are with his history. He wrestled in Puerto Rico as TNT, and he kind of had like a martial arts background. It was more like his Quang gimmick than it was anything else that he did. Very Oriental stereotypes used, and he had a... He didn't have a mask, but he had, like, face paint, almost like Muda. Very similar face paint to the great Muda. and was super over there. Had a lot of title championship runs there. He was never going to be a top guy here, and kind of my point of contention with his whole booking Savio Vega in this spot was this could have worked. How they booked this tournament could have worked had they used anyone but Savio Vega, and there's a handful of guys they could have.
Well, first off, I question one of two things. I'm wondering if, with Savio, if they decided to give him this push because they ran the Hall of Fame during this pay-per-view. I think it was like the night before or whatever.
Yeah.
And one of the inductees was Pedro Morales, which was one of the Puerto Rican World Heavyweight Champion in the 70s and was big for the Puerto Rican fan base. And I'm almost wondering if Vince went to that because he's inducting Pedro Morales into the Hall of Fame and seeing if he could do what his dad did and kind of strike lightning in a bottle and get this guy over.
The problem with that is Pedro Morales no-showed the Hall of Fame. He didn't even show up for that. He was the only one that they've been doing the Hall of Fame that has no-showed that's been alive. And it was because he was working in WCW as a color commentator for their Spanish announce team. So he didn't want to lose his job. So while I agree that may have been a great idea, but pairing him with Razor made no sense. Because Razor is not Puerto Rican. He was playing a Cuban character. It's not the same country. I know Vince gets those confused, but pairing never really worked for me. And Savio was only in the company for about a month when they did this. So no one really knew who he was at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, because they were trying to push it hard. Because, you know, they do some stuff later on, which we won't get too much into, really showing his heritage and kind of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think it was ever an idea to push him. I really think that they are just in a spot, and in their head, they had already kind of debuted him as Razor's buddy. He was trying to help Razor out and blah, blah, blah. So with Razor being hurt, and Razor is supposed to have his big role in there, hey, well, since he's hurt, let's put this guy that's been with him for a couple of weeks, see if we can get something out of him with Razor in his corner the whole time. And honestly, just failed miserably,
I think. The crowd didn't buy it. There was a part during the pay-per-view, and I know we're kind of jumping ahead, where he kind of goes, come on, like he's trying to rev up as a babyface would, and it's just dead silence. And we're talking about a huge wrestling city like Philadelphia, and it is just crickets for him. And it kind of felt bad because he was put in a bad spot. He really was.
You know, there was an interesting thing that's kind of a little bit off topic, but about Savio that I never knew too much about him prior to, you know, seeing him when I started watching it in '95. And on the Jim Cornette show, Cornette had did a kayfabe commentaries on Puerto Rico with Savio. And I guess Savio was one of the guys there the night Brody got stabbed.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
He saw everything. And Cornette talked a little bit about it, but I guess they talk for about a half hour on the DVD when it comes out. But I guess it's pretty chilling about the way Savio.
Yeah, see, Savio wrestled as TNT from I think for about 8 years or so before he ever came to the WWF in Puerto Rico. So you know, he was there for a while, you know. So he, you know, and I think he started working like, I want to say it was his rookie year was when the Brody murder happened. If I'm not mistaken,
he actually tried out straight out of high school for the WWF. The only reason why he was in Puerto Rico is they sent him there. He had a tryout, and they signed him and sent him to WWC to kind of get some seasoning because he was literally fresh out of school.
Holy shit!
Yeah,
that's wild.
Yeah, so he, I mean, he has a pretty long history with the company.
That's ridiculous, dude. No, I just didn't know that.
First match was Savio Vega versus IRS in a qualifying match to replace Razor Ramon in the tournament. So, Joe, do you have any background on kind of any build towards this?
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to remember who IRS faced in order to get to the qualifying match. But I do know that, like, as far as Savio and Razor go, that Razor had wrestled in the first In Your House against Roddy and Jeff Jarrett in a 2-on-1 handicap match. I think it was like partway through the match as he's getting double teamed. Savio came in and really made the save. So that's really where Savio got his start as far as the weeks leading up to it. And I know Razor wrestled, I think like the first Monday Night Raw back from In Your House. He wrestled a jobber and Savio was in his corner and blah, 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 blah. But anyways, Razor qualified for the thing on a Superstars taping. He ended up getting hurt and then letting Savio take his place. So that's really all I...
Do you know how Razor got hurt?
I know his ribs were pretty banged up. At least that's he what hurt. the storyline was or whatever.
Yeah, no, it was legitimate. He actually hurt his ribs in a house show ladder match against Jeff Jarrett. So I just thought it was wild. I mean, because I wonder, because I've never heard much about this pay-per-view. Do you think that the plan from the get-go was for Mabel to go over, like, say, Razor? Or do you think maybe Razor was going to get the rub and win the King of the Ring? Or I wonder how much this really offset their plans.
All the research that I have suggests that Mabel was the guy.
Okay.
And it was just, Savio was kind of playing the role that they were planning for Razor going into this pay-per-view.
But to me, this is another thing that really gets me. If that's the case, you know, I guess it's one of many things, at least in this pay-per-view, but at least when it comes to Razor, you know, you got him, he has this the great match with Bret Hart in the opening match in 93. He has a heck of a match with Owen Hart in 94. And he's scheduled to, if it goes his way, he goes all the way to the finals with Mabel. How much are they going to freaking bury this guy when you push a 600-pound or 500-pound fucking Mabel when the fans clearly don't want him, but yet would want Razor instead? Makes no sense.
I guess the booking, the logic behind it was they wanted a monster for Diesel to slay. And so, and you know, Vince is with the big guys, regardless of their body type, and Mabel's a big, giant grape, so
well,
he probably thought it was something he could squash.
Well, even still, I mean, I think Razor's just a teeny bit shorter than Diesel, though, but I mean, I would guess that's the problem of turning Diesel babyface, because if you'd have just kept him heel, then you probably could have just let Razor win the King of the Ring and face Diesel at SummerSlam, which probably would have been a better main event than Mabel versus Diesel.
Yeah. So this match was only about 5 minutes long. It was pretty standard. Most of the matches on this card were incredibly short, and I'm thankful for that because all of them were bad. I can't think of one good match on this card.
Well, I mean, there were some that are kind of better duds than the worst duds. So.
Yeah. But, I mean, most of them were pretty awful.
Yeah.
So after this match, Doc Hendricks, which is like a PSA for those that don't, It's basically Michael P.S. Hayes on blow is what Doc Hendricks is. He was hawking and jumping around, like twitching, like he had this weird twitch. And even like partway through him trying to sell this Kiss My Foot match, which was happening later on in the evening, Vince kind of looks at him like, are you okay? Like, I don't know if any of you caught that, but even Vince kind of like broke character and looked at him like he was losing his mind.
Yeah,
I'm sure that was a regular occurrence.
And there's another spot we'll talk about later with Doc Hendricks that I didn't particularly care for and thought kind of harmed some of the guys that were in the tournament, but we'll get there shortly.
What's funny to me is I remember when I first saw Doc Hendricks, I think it was like that one of their Sunday shows, I think it was like Live Wire or something like that, and he was the host of it, I think it was Sonny. And he just reminded me of like one of your drunk uncles at a family reunion, like the goofball. And I didn't know who he was. But now that I know who he is, and then you listen to his promos and you come and watch this, it's like, good God, he made Vince seem like Howard Cosell in this fucking thing.
Yeah, really. He was pretty brutal. I didn't mind. I liked Vince's on commentary as much as people hated him. He never really bothered me, but he was even terrible on the show.
Oh, he was.
Yeah, I don't think they had real strong chemistry either.
Well, my question is, when it comes to Doc during the show, is he supposed to be a heel commentator or a good or a babyface? Because at times he sounds like he's going through like the babyface spiel, but then every once in a while he'll act sort of heelish, and it's like, well, what the fuck? Where are you?
Well, I think it's
one of those things where they wanted him to kind of be like in the middle in a way, like he was an asshole, but he wouldn't agree with, like, the real dastardly heels or, you know, I don't know. They probably didn't know what the fuck they wanted him to do either.
Probably didn't help that he was coked out of his mind either, so.
Might as well have fucking Stephanie Weiland fucking doing the play-by-play with fucking Vince.
Probably would have been better.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the very first-round match, Savio Vega is back out there with Yokozuna and Jim Cornette. Vega goes over an 8:24 via count out. There was kind of a schmoz finish with Owen Hart running out and Razor getting involved. Joe, do you have any background on this?
The only thing that I got was that the Yokozuna wrestled Lex Luger for the preliminary match, and on the June 12th of Raw, and Yoko won by a count out when he did the leg drop on the arena floor. So obviously they're burying Lex Luger still at this time, and giving Yoko the little bit of a bump, but not much. I know Owen didn't do this match or this King of the Ring because he was injured. As far as how Yoko's
speaking of Owen, I don't know if you saw this or not, Joe. Owen and Davey Boy actually had a King of the Ring qualifier match.
Yeah.
And they went to a 15-minute time limit. Now, from what I understand, I could be wrong about this, the kayfabe reason for the Yoko-Lex match even happening, they weren't even supposed to be in the King of the Ring, kayfabe-wise. But because of the draw between Owen and Davey Boy, they put this match together because, like, well, we got to have somebody in the spot, which I thought was neat. You know, I've never heard of them doing anything since even close to that, you know. So I thought, you know, well, these two partners didn't qualify. Let's give the other two partners a chance.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. The one thing that caught me about this match was just how big Yokozuna got at this point in his career. And Doc Hendricks actually pointed it out during the match that he was well over 640 pounds at this point, which he claimed was the biggest wrestler in history, even bigger than Haystacks Calhoun, which I don't know if that's accurate or not, but it would not shock me if he was. And it definitely impacted his work and his ability to move around the ring.
Well, I'll say this, too. I mean, around this time, he was huge. I don't think he was that big. Yoko, by the next year, would be much bigger. It wasn't even the biggest he would ever get.
I think he was. They had a joke. I know when he fell off the ropes. The ropes broke when he tried to splash off. And this is before Austin became Austin.
Mm-hmm.
They were
SummerSlam.
Somewhere between 750 and 800 pounds.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, they always exaggerate a little bit, but I mean, it probably wasn't much of an exaggeration.
No. So he's probably pushing 650, 700 then, and that's a massive man.
Mm. Big time.
One thing I do want to note about you talking about Vince's terrible commentary during this match, well, this whole pay-per-view. So Vince is going out of his way, and I kind of understood later why he made such a point to make this point, because of some of the results that I won't spoil yet. But a direct Vince quote is, all these matches have 15-minute time limits, and you must win to advance. Well, no shit. How else are you going to advance if you don't fucking win? I instantly was like, well, this is how the fuck the rest of this night's going to go. But the one good thing about this entire match is I absolutely love the Jim Cornette apron bump.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever a babyface hits him, he just shoots his legs in the air and falls to his ass. And I don't give a shit about the rest of the match.
Well, that's even like when I went back and watched some of the Raws and, you know, Yoko was tagging with Owen in a match that wasn't, or it was a Yoko preliminary match, or even when Cornette was managing Mantar. I think that was in the Spark Plug Bob Holly match. That he's fantastic in this era in '95. I mean, some of the stuff that he's coming off with, standing ringside when the camera gets on him, it's fantastic. Him yelling at the fans, him taking the bumps, and just he's the best.
Oh, he's so fucking good, man. One thing, though, I mean, the match was what it was. I mean, wasn't that great? I actually enjoyed the finish because they at least tried to keep Yoko strong.
And he took a hell of a bump on those steps. I always liked when he would do that bump, because he would just kind of mold over the steps or the pole or whatever he hit, like the blob, and just kind of fall over. It looked believable.
God, yes, we had to. That's fucking like 600 pounds of meat just flipping over the place, you know?
The next match after that was Rhodey, which is the Road Dog, with Jeff Jarrett, and he defeated Bob Sparkplug Holly in 7 minutes and 11 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
This match kind of had a weird finish to it.
I, that's what I had in my notes, too. It's like, the match wasn't, as a whole, the match was not bad. It's just nothing noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just whatever. I don't think I have ever seen someone lose to taking the boot off of jumping off the top rope ever. Like, that's like a double down spot. That's like a hope spot. That's like a fucking middle of the match spot, and fucking Bob Holly's just like, nope, I'm dead.
Well, you know what? Well, I'll get into this now before I forget. Like I said earlier, Bob Holly got into this King of the Ring tournament by beating Mantar. I'm not sure if this is one of the last times you see Mantar, but he beat him nonetheless. And then Jarrett was actually supposed to be in the King of the Ring. He cut a promo saying he would defeat The Undertaker, but he lost. So the Roadie beat Doink on an episode of Superstars to advance. So that's how these two got into there. But watching this, Gary and I just watched a little bit of Smoky Mountain Wrestling not too long ago. And you got Bob Holly being Hollywood Bob Holly. And you got him here being Spark Plug Bob Holly. And I told Gary, I said, you know, we would crap on this match now, but if this match was in 97 and this is the Road Dog versus Hardcore Holly, none of us would bat an eye about this fucking thing.
Yeah, it's funny because I put that in there. I was like, Spark Plug versus Roadie. This is 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And in a couple of years, these guys would wrestle. I mean, they fucking wrestled on pay-per-view for the Hardcore title like 2 years later or 3 years later. You know, like, people loved it then. It's just weird. And like I said, I didn't think the match was bad. One thing that I thought was kind of funny is that his the Roadie's gear, that motherfucker successfully from, like, 95 when he became the Roadie to now when he randomly come back up as Road Dog, never had to change his gear. He always kept the fucking shirt and baggy pants look.
Yeah, I noticed that too. The only thing he really changed was his shitty Medusa-style haircut that he had with the long dreads.
Well, he did bring that back as Road Dog, so kind of.
He did, yeah. It wasn't quite as long.
Well, he,
obnoxious.
And then he shaved the sides down or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, I always thought that Road Dog and even Bob Holly, they're really good workers, but I don't know if because the structure of this King of the Ring match or pay-per-view, I know obviously they're trying to account for time and get everything in, but I don't know. I would have just rather seen them have a little bit more time and probably tell a better story than, all right, we just got to hurry up and get the Roadie to beat Bob Holly and just move on to the next match.
Why wasn't Jarrett in this tournament?
He was, but he lost to The Undertaker.
Oh, he lost. Okay. That popped up. I'm like, why the hell is Roadie in it and Jarrett's managing him? It should be the other way around. But okay, that makes more sense.
It is still weird, though, that they would do this. They would use Jarrett as the second instead of using him in the actual tournament, you know, instead of the qualifier. It's strange, you know, but that's 95.
But that's one of the things that I have a gripe with about this pay-per-view, that you have the workers like Shawn, Undertaker, you know, you didn't put Jarrett in there, he lost, but you have some of these workers on there, but yet you don't put these workers or let them advance far in the tournament. And I don't get it. I just don't get why they did what they did, but I guess that'll be the story of the whole thing.
So, moving on, there was a coked out Shawn Michaels promo here before this next one. Like, did anyone understand what he said? Because I watched it 3 or 4 times and could not comprehend anything that he was going on about.
I replayed the last segment of the promo he cut, because he said something and then Todd Pettengill, like, you know, gave his fucking smile. I could not figure out what the fuck he said.
This era of Shawn Michaels is my favorite and least favorite. Now, let me explain what I mean by that real fast. Shawn Michaels, the wrestler, I think, in 95 was pretty much hot garbage. How Vince McMahon saw him as the next fucking face of the company blows my mind. Because you could just tell, like, in his matches, sure, he's athletic, but he's all over the fucking place and in a bad way. That he's stoned the fuck up. He's coked the fuck up. You know, whatever. But, I mean, yeah, this one is a little incoherent, but his charisma around this time, whether be it natural or drug and fucking fueled or whatever, his charisma was at an all-time high, you know? So, I don't know. It's like, I loved his gear around this time, which has nothing to do with Shawn Michaels, the fucking performer, but Shawn Michaels' 95 gear as a whole from the beginning to end was amazing. But some of his match qualities are pretty much hot fucking garbage. And today is no different.
This is his first pay-per-view as a babyface, as a major player, as a babyface. So to see what they did with him in this match, which he goes and faces Kama and they go to a 15-minute draw is kind of bizarre to me, especially if Vince is pegging him as one of the future babyface stars of the company to kind of have him tittle out to a guy. I mean, I guess he was higher on the card at this point because they were building up to a feud with The Undertaker, but I don't know.
Is there any chance that he snorted a line of coke off of his vest he brought out? It seems like it'd be like the perfect mirror to break that up and stuff up on and just snort one right before he goes out there.
I would imagine there's a pretty good chance he sniffed a line of coke off of Vince's boner.
There we go.
Terrible.
Maybe that's why Todd Pettengill was smiling. You know what I found funny was going back and watching these Raw rewinds or whatever, and they're like 45 minutes long, so they cut out a lot of the filler, that Todd Pettengill had a mullet at In Your House 1. Fast forward a month, 2 months, and now he's like fucking straight-laced and his hair's fucking tight going on there. It just cracked me up for whatever reason.
Yeah, fuck Todd Pettengill.
Oh, fuck.
What I think about that son of a bitch.
I was going to say Stephanie Weiland has a hot soccer mom look about her. I'm like, man, I'd like to see her parade around her fucking mom jeans. Woo.
Hey, she can get it, all right?
Sure, why not?
Oh, fuck.
Speaking of 95 and hot chicks that weren't here, where the fuck was Sunny? She was in the company.
Well, they were trying to make her some news, famous news person. They were running that bullshit gimmick for her. You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wasn't she supposed to be, like, Irish or something like that? Like, didn't they give her, like, an Irish name?
Yeah, they gave her some weird name, and they made her look like Katie Couric, and she was doing, like, a news blast from the event center.
Yeah.
Well, I need to go check that out. But, okay,
yeah,
so, well, goddammit, we could have used her instead, but no, we get the soccer.
It made a lot more sense.
Like I said last week on the last episode, 95 Sunny, harder than a crack pipe on payday.
Sir. God damn it. Sunny, he didn't mean it.
He does.
I do.
Well,
if he
does,
I do.
Well, I don't.
Gort apparently wants you to sit on a glass coffee table.
God damn it. How are we bringing back a Jimmy Valiant line? God almighty. Where was this gone?
Woo, Mercedes.
Who the fuck is the rock and roll? Oh, God, yeah. What the fuck else is new?
That's our gimmick. We just derail.
All right. Let's get to goddamn Shawn Michaels and Kama.
Yeah.
Let's get away from the shit. All right.
It wasn't actually a bad match.
No, I like it.
It wasn't a great match, but it
was. I was bored, honestly. Like you said, it wasn't terrible, but it was nothing special. But let's talk, who cares about the match? Let's talk about before the match real fast. Number one, so we have like some Undertaker fans, quote unquote, in the crowd.
Yeah, that was real weird.
Super fucking weird. Like, what was the point in going that far with that?
Yeah.
Well, I think the build was that Kama's, that Mr. T chain that he had, that was the urn.
Yeah.
That was he had melted it down or whatever.
Yeah, I remember that. But just, I don't know, the fans, I thought was weird. Another thing I thought was very weird, I don't know if it was done on purpose or not, did y'all notice that Shawn's music randomly cut in the middle of the song?
No. Yeah. I didn't notice.
Yeah.
They did the same thing with Lawler later in the show, too.
Oh, see, I didn't even catch his.
Yeah, he was like halfway down the album before his music kicked on.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So before we talk about this match, or I guess we already are, but Kama beat Duke Drosy on Superstars to qualify for this, and then Shawn came back. It was like a big thing on Raw. Shawn's coming back. And he come back and he took on King Kong Bundy on the April 3rd edition of Raw to win his qualifying match. And that was that same Raw at the end is where you get Diesel and Bam Bam watching on the monitors in the back. And then after the match, Diesel and Bam Bam came down the ring. Diesel and Shawn did that classic, you know, jumping high five. And those three celebrated in the ring, and then Raw won off the air.
I thought, I didn't mind this iteration of Kama. I thought this character was kind of interesting. I think it was a little bit of ahead of its time. Had this happened when UFC was kind of blasting off, I think it would have been interesting. I think Charles Wright, in general, is vastly underrated. He had four completely different gimmicks in the WWE, and I thought they were all over. Papa Shango, then he had this MMA gimmick, and then he was a Nation of Domination before he went into The Godfather. And then he could even do five if you count the Right to Censor shit. But I didn't think he was bad in the ring either. I thought in this match his offense was very believable. It was sloppy. It wasn't crisp or technical in any sense. But his punches and his kicks and his clotheslines and his strikes were believable to me. I didn't hate this match at all.
I didn't really hate it either. I mean, it's of course this match, and I think even we could probably agree maybe another match down the road is a little bit just as good. But you know, those two to me stand out. And I mean, yeah, I know Court said he felt bored. I felt okay watching this match. I do notice that Sean did his classic overselling, when it was, you know, one of his trademarks. But I don't know. I just thought that Kama, to me at least, stood out more so than Sean did.
I completely agree with that. I do think though that like the best spot of the entire match was after the fucking match was over. When Sean did that baseball slide into the sweet game music, that was sweet as hell. But I do agree with everything y'all are saying. I mean, Kama was fucking badass in this whole match. I really believe like Kama could have beat Sean. I just feel like, to me, watching it, and maybe this is just my fucking overexposure to the business, I could tell from the get-go, and I haven't watched this in years, so I honestly God, I didn't know who was going to win. But once I started watching it, I can tell that they were just wasting time to get to the time limit. Mm-hmm. That was my only gripe. And yeah, the match wasn't bad. I just, once I figured that out, to me they made it obvious, and I just lost every bit of interest in the match that I could, because the ending was going to be so predictable for me.
Well, I'm just curious, though, like, and I keep going back to this, you know, what if thing, but why in the hell, you know, with Sean and even with The Undertaker coming up, you know, why these guys, you're putting them in the King of the Ring just to waste them? I feel like that they should have been in a better spot. I mean, I guess the Taker one you could say was helping get Mabel a little bit over and as a threat, but at least Sean, because at this time, I mean, Sean's coming off his Royal Rumble win, his WrestleMania main event, and then he's going to head into SummerSlam against Razor. So I just feel like, to me, it's a waste of him in there if he's not going to win.
Oh, God, yeah. That's one of my comments. Sean is at the rise of his career. Why the fuck is he randomly in this match, right, for the tournament? They could have easily put Bam Bam in the spot instead and put Sean in the main event with Diesel. It made bullshit, no sense. To have even, yeah, it's a draw. I mean, maybe they thought they were going to have bigger plans for Kama. I mean, I know I'm jumping ahead, but having Undertaker in this fucking tournament blew my mind. Maybe because in the past, you know, like, okay, the first year you did have like superstars like Bret, Bam Bam, Luger. 94, it was more your mid-card guys. You know, you had Razor, you had Owen. 95, maybe they were trying to sneak in those guys who are supposed to be the main event guys, maybe to drum up some more interest. But I agree, all these guys seemed out of place to be in this fucking tournament. They had nothing to gain.
Why do you think they decided to go with a draw in this match?
I guess just to keep both of them strong, knowing that you got Sean, who I think Vince already saw as, maybe, I don't think he saw him as the top babyface yet, but he saw him as a on-the-rise top babyface. Then you had Kama, who was just about to go into a big program, or he's in the middle of a big program with Taker, so you don't want him to lose to look weak yet, because you got to wait and have build him up to lose to Taker. I think it was just one of those situations where you got two guys that you have plans for. Let's not have either one of them lose, and plus you have the bye, so you've got Mabel, who, let's be honest, was very limited, and gives him a chance to rest. I think all of that went into account on this, honestly.
That makes sense. I was curious because part of me is wondering if somebody pulled the I'm not doing the job card in this match. And, I mean, Sean, at this point in his career, even was not above doing that. So I was I almost wondered if that was part of it too, but yeah, your explanation makes a lot of sense.
One thing that I noticed about this match, and maybe I'm wrong, how worthless outside of the backstage promos DiBiase is as a manager on the sides. Like it just seems like he's just there. Didn't seem like he really added.
Honestly, I agree.
He was never a really strong manager. Which you would think, if you go back to the 80s during that main run, that golden era run, if you went and back and picked out guys who you thought may be good managers in the future, DiBiase would be at the top of my list. And he never really impressed me, the Million Dollar Corporation, all that. He always cut good promos, and that was, but yeah, the outside of the ring stuff, the stuff that you were talking about with Cornette that he does so well, DiBiase did none of that. So, yeah, I would totally agree. I thought he was kind of useless out there, too.
I've always heard, I don't know if it goes like along with this as far as him being a manager also, that I think I heard Bruce Pritchard talk about it, when DiBiase also said it. He's a terrible teacher. That's why he's not like at the performance center and shit like that, because like he can sit down and do whatever the fuck it is he needs to do for himself. But when it comes to trying to do something with somebody else, he draws a blank. It's like it's some kind of like a writer's block for him in a way. So I wonder if that's why he wasn't that great as a manager. Because in his head, he's used to, I'm in the ring doing this, doing that. He doesn't know how to act like a manager. Could be wrong, but maybe it's kind of one and the same.
And I've heard that on the Writer's Room podcast. He was on there, and he essentially said that himself, that he wasn't a good teacher. He knew what he needed to do, but to verbalize that to someone, to show someone else what that was, he wasn't able to make that bridge. So, yeah, that's even aware of that, I think. So, and I think that's why he got out of creative so quickly when he had that short run there in the early 2000s. Yeah. So the next segment was this weird Bob Backlund for president segment. I didn't know if either one of you guys had anything you wanted to cover with that.
I do have a comment. So I can't remember. I don't know what the actual name of the song is. But I don't know if you noticed in the background, the song that's playing was the very first when they went to All-American Lex Luger. That was his theme song. Less than, that was like a year and a half ago at this point, and they're reusing it for something else, and Luger's still around in the company. Yeah, his music has changed. I thought that was a little worth note to me, because I'm like, hey, Lex Luger, oh, no, it's a Bob Backlund promo. Because I got bored of shit with the pay-per-view already by this point, so I wasn't even looking at the TV, but I heard the music. Another thing I thought was weird, though, was that, so, this is, what the next match is Taker and Mabel. They do the build up to Taker and Mabel, then randomly cut to the Bob Backlund thing, and then cut back to the match. Like, did they forget the Bob Backlund thing? Did they go to it too early? It seemed very out of place.
I don't think they had their top production team there. Because they missed the finish of the Yokozuna match in the first round too. We didn't cover that. They were going with Owen down the aisle, and they completely missed the bump that kind of knocked Yokozuna out. And there was a little like hiccups with the entrance music and not being on cue for certain things. This show was just a fucking disaster from top to bottom. So I'm almost wondering, they either had a really off night or they had the B team in, which would be weird for a pay-per-view. But
I was really hoping that at one point, Backlund standing on that carriage, he'd have fell out and knocked out his fucking front tooth or something. Because good God, was this fucking awful. I mean, I remember the whole Backlund running for president thing, and I think I kind of had I thought it would turn out better than I remember, because I remember as a kid thinking it was kind of funny or whatever, because this fucking guy's goofy. But watching the Raw segments of him talking about his campaign, and then watching this, it was just awful. I was just like, ugh. It was like cringeworthy almost, how awkward and terrible this felt. And I'm sure that was the point, I hope, because it certainly worked, but God, was that terrible.
I've heard that because of this, he actually really played with the idea of trying to run to be president. Mm-hmm. Who knows if it's true? I mean, goddamn crazy as Bob Backlund, nothing surprises me. But you know what? I wonder if he actually is. Now, go with me here. So, Bob Backlund's one of those guys, one of those rare guys who's still very old school, right? So, Bob Backlund, up until about 1994, was a completely normal, howdy-doody type person. All of a sudden, WWF, he now has this crazy lunatic character, and he's never let go of it since. Do you think he just keeps the fucking gimmick?
My professional opinion is, trying to keep kayfabe with my real-time job, is, is that he's crazy. That he has some sort of mental health disorder. And wow. The evidence that I have to back that up is, there was an angle plan for Papa Shango to come back in 95, before they did the MMA Kama Mustafa gimmick. And they were going to have him be the reason as to why Bob Backlund has been acting so crazy lately, that he put some voodoo spell on him, and that's why he was acting crazy. They were going to do that, so 95 could have been worse. That being said, I think they realized that, oh, this is a shoot. He actually is fucking crazy. He's not going to be able to go back because we've kind of let the cat out of the bag with his mental illness, and they scrapped it. That's just my working theory on it.
Which is surprising because I know that in 85, Vince wanted Backlund to be a heel. And he said that he didn't want to be a heel because he had, I think, one or two young daughters going to school and didn't want that to be hell on them going to school. So that's why he didn't turn and he went elsewhere. But if he's legitimately crazy, I mean, I guess that explains a lot, but I don't know. Him talking about sticking a carrot in a meat sandwich kind of threw me off a little bit there.
You say 95 could have been worse.
Yes. It absolutely was the worst.
Go ahead.
He had a hell of a time spitting out cheesesteak when he was going through that promo. He forgot where he was at and was just staring at this fucking Philadelphia cheesesteak trying to figure out where he was going to go with that promo. I have a tough time believing that was their best take.
The fucking lithium wore off at that point.
It may have. Speaking of complete and utter insanity, the last first round match featured the eventual winner, Mabel, with his manager now, former tag team partner Mo, defeating The Undertaker with Paul Bearer in 10:44. Interesting of note, this is the first televised loss that The Undertaker had since Tuesday in Texas in 1991. Mabel ended a 3-plus-year televised winning streak for The Undertaker.
Holy shit. See, I blocked that out of my head. In my head, it was always Mankind that ended the streak. I didn't realize it was Mabel. Holy fuck.
Well, how these guys got here, like I said earlier, Taker beat Jared. But Mabel squashed Adam Baum in the first, In Your House. That was the first qualifier match. Which, when you look back, though, with Mabel and his whole thing, I mean, it's only really a year since WrestleMania 10 when him and Mo were baby faces and they beat the Quebecers. And then all of a sudden, I forget when it is, but you see him turn on Oscar and become the bad guys.
They tried to save it by saying that because The Undertaker lost his urn to Kama and Kama melted it into a necklace, that his powers were kind of dissipating and he was not The Undertaker of old. However, as much as I just put over Kama 2 minutes ago, he had maybe the worst run-in I've ever seen. He ran in and did the lightest, softest kick to the Undertaker's side, and then Undertaker just flopped over dead. Mabel hit a leg drop, and that was it. So it was pretty much as clean as a heel was going to get. There was no beat down at all. The referee was out, so he could have really laid it in to kind of, you know, sell the fact that he beat the shit out of the Undertaker. But it was horrible.
You mean to tell me that just because he lost the urn and that he didn't have his powers, you mean those two creepy-looking meth users in the front row couldn't help him out?
Oh, shit. They were the creatures of the night.
Holy shit. They looked like they
ran in. Two goth twinks could have ran in and just laid an ass-whooping on him. That would have been amazing.
They were probably the founders of the Hot Topic sitting in the fucking front row.
Yeah, probably. Hashtag.
I like this wrestling so much, in a few years we'll be selling Young Bucks shirts.
God damn it. He used to work there.
Do you have any good Hot Topic stories?
Not that I could talk about on air.
Oh, shit.
Oh, you motherfucker. We'll save it for after.
Hashtag repressed memories.
After hours. We're going to start having a premium podcast, Ringside Chat After Hours, featuring Court Montgomery. So if you want to hear all these racy stories that he can't say on the air for legal reasons, send money to my email address. I will give you my PayPal, and I will not share that with Joe or Court.
Or, wait a minute, instead of
shout the fuck out. These are my goddamn stories.
How about we just take the money and try to get Virgil on the fucking show?
No, how about we get the money so I can talk to Sonny?
Well, I'm pretty sure that if you just tell her that you just want to do the glass table gimmick, then it'll be all right.
Sure. We derailed again.
The money to pay for the poop.
The money shark.
Oh, my God.
Oh, fuck.
And we're back off track.
So Maple and Taker, huh?
No, wait a goddamn minute. Hold on. we can't just go back that quick.
Why not?
Well, it was a shitty match, and I just said short, so we can go back.
Well, in my notes, I literally have Undertaker versus Maple. I'm going to tell y'all, word for word, every note I have for this match. All right. Undertaker versus Maple. Dot, 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 dot. Poor Taker. Meh. Dot, 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 dot. Mabel wins. All right, on to the next match.
So before the next match, they had the Hall of Fame banquet ceremony, like, video. And all I could think about is how sad the Hall of Fame banquet ceremony was in 1995 in comparison to what it is now.
Yeah,
that's what I put on there. That it's crazy to see how much different it is. It's so small and like a fucking banquet.
Yeah,
it looks like a cheap like wedding reception for like a third cousin that you see maybe once every 5 years.
Well, yeah, and then not only that too, but they didn't. I mean, I know a couple of the inductees were, I know, well, you stated earlier, Pedro Morales no showed, but then two of them are dead. And I think really you've got a more of a longer looking shot of Moolah doing her induction than you did seeing Steele or Putski or Ernie Ladd, which kind of surprised me a little bit.
They spent a lot of time on Putski's induction.
I might have passed out
by that. I forget where I heard it at, but Vince was enamored with him, and there was rumors that he was going to bring Putski back. I forget, right around this time. This is the mid-90s we're talking about, and he was going to bring him back as an active worker, and they talked him out like, Vince, he's not the Putski of the 1970s and early 80s. It's 1995 Ivan Putski.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they tried to bring his son in and give him a spot, and that the shit did not work out.
No, it did not. We could do a whole episode on second generation failed wrestlers.
I did find it funny, though, that they inducted Antonino Rocca. And, you know, he was known for his acrobatic wrestling style. And his inductee was Diesel, the least likely acrobatic wrestler of all time.
Don't get me fucking started on Diesel. I'll talk about him in a little bit.
But, well, I mean, I guess I could probably just run down, like, yeah, you know, they inducted Rocca. Ernie Ladd got inducted by Bobo Brazil. George Steele got inducted by Doink. Ivan Putski got inducted, I'm guessing, by Scott Putski. Moolah got inducted by Alondra Blaze. The Grand Wizard by Sergeant Slaughter. And then Savio Vega was Pedro Morales' inductee. That was it I take it back. That was it until next year.
All right, so moving on. The first semifinal match featured Savio Vega in his third match of the night, defeating the Roadie with Jeff Jarrett in 6.5 minutes. I noticed this was the match where the crowd kind of started turning on the show. Noticed some boos. This is the moment where Savio Vega was trying to rev up the crowd, and it was dead silent. They were starting to have a lot of problems with the crowd at this point.
They probably were fucking tired of seeing Savio, man. Like you said, this is his third appearance on the card. He wins this fucking match. He's got to come back a fourth time. Who was a good idea to have this motherfucker work four times and cut a promo after this match that fucking just buried him?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Thank you. And that was kind of what I was alluding to earlier when we were talking about Doc Hendricks. Whose bright idea was it to have Doc Hendricks come over and do translation for a promo while the guy that he's insulting is standing there, understands English, Savio Vega has cut English promos before, and Razor Ramon, who is English and can speak English, sitting there, he just shit-talked them right to their face, and they did nothing. They just sat there with smiles on their face. They look like the biggest jabronis on earth. You're trying to build Savio Vega as this hero that's kind of conquering all, against all the odds, and you had Michael PSAs basically take a hot dump on their chest. And I know, Court, you're into that with Sonny and all the glass stuff, but yeah, this made no fucking sense.
Is there any chance that Doc Hendricks literally thought he was talking to his drug dealer?
No.
With Savio standing there.
And Joey with the racist comment in there already.
I'm just saying, he's probably like, hey...
Michael Hayes did fucking drop some racist shit in this.
He did.
So,
And you know what, though? The whole thing is, when I went back and I watched the Raws, there was one that they, I think it was the night after In Your House, they cut to an interview with Savio in the back. And Savio's, like, just teeing off, like, going, you know, talking Puerto Rican, and then, like, stops, talks English, and then starts ranting and raving in Latin again, like he just doesn't know what the hell's going on, and then it cut to Lawler and Vince just sitting there looking like, well, what the fuck's going on here?
Well, you know what I think about this whole goddamn show? This whole goddamn show.
Oh, God.
Is Sonny there?
This... Mine was a little better than that, at least. But no, goddamn it, just fuck Savio Vega, okay?
This is a mess.
That's how I feel about Savio Vega, okay? That's just where we're going with this.
Well, let's just move on. Alright, so, goddamn it.
Well, I wanted to say real quick, though, you know, why have, going back to Doc Hendricks a little bit, why of all people do you send him out when you've already had Todd Pettengill out there, you've already had, I don't know if it's at this point or unless it's the finals, where Stephanie Weiland comes out there and talks to Mabel, you already have those two, why send him out there?
Because he's already speaking to them, and I think he did it on his own.
Unless Vince was like, you know what, just take a microphone and go out there and see what you can do out there. Just get away from me for about 10 minutes while I try to compose myself.
That's the thing. If he would have did it just sitting there with Vince, like, I'm going to translate over them speaking Spanish to each other, that would have been okay. That would have worked and not made your two baby faces look like gigantic pussies. It would have still been stupid, but it would have made more sense. But to have him go over there, and he sounded like he about tripped 4 times on the way over, if you actually listen to it. There's all kind of static and stumbling. It's because he's blazed out of his gourd. And then go over, shit-talk them right to their face, and then leave completely unscathed made no sense. That was my biggest gripe with that.
It's 95, dude. This surprised you.
I don't know. Honestly, as I was thinking about this, and I know you don't want to talk about the current product, so put your earmuffs on. 95, really the only difference between 95 and now is the match quality. The match quality is so good now that it kind of makes up for the shitty angles. But the angles are just as bad now as they are in 95. Okay, take your muffs off. Somebody tell Court to take his muffs off.
Well, I mean, even so, I mean, I agree with that. And the funny thing is that, you know, the current product is doing it with, you know, a loaded roster compared to this roster. It just, I don't know. It just, to me, it just seems like, I don't know if Vince decided to have a brain fart in the 90s and not wake up until, you know, WCW's, you know, knocking on their door or something. But it's just like, Vince is like, ha-ha, I just love it, or whatever, and thinks everything's fucking fantastic, but man, was it the shit.
They're incredibly lucky that WCW was so terrible in 95 too. Because just imagine the next year is where WCW really started picking up steam. Imagine if they had another full year of momentum built up against the WWE. We may not be talking about WWE Raw in 2017. We may be talking about WCW Nitro or something completely different if they would have continued down the financial path that they were at. We may be back into the territory days where we have segmented shit because we don't have a national promotion because they're both dead.
Well, no, that's very true. But, of course, WCW is just WCW. And I just, it's amazing that they didn't either take advantage of it or, hell, I mean, I know ECW is young at this point, but it's a wonder that WWF was ever able to really come back and book Philadelphia after this flipping show.
And it doesn't get any better because the next match is the Kiss My Foot match with Bret Hart defeating Jerry Lawler in 9 minutes and 20 seconds. And if there is a match that sums up Bret Hart's 1995, it is this one.
Well, okay, so I've got something I've written here that I wanted to ask you guys before we get too much into it. I mean, well, here's my first comment. I mean, yeah, Lawler kind of had to leave because of his court stuff in 93, and he got put back on the commentary in 94, whatever. But off and on, these motherfuckers feuded for like 2.5 years. It was like, so I feel like that Vince liked Bret and wanted Bret to be his top guy, but I feel like he was afraid to completely pull the trigger on Bret. Because, you know, Bret won the belt in 92, dropped it to Yoko, then wins it back in 94, drops it later that year, and doesn't get it back till, like, what was it, 96?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weird. All right, you're fine. I just don't understand, like,
yeah.
Bret had a very similar run in WWF, at least around this time, and Sting did in WCW. Like, they're both considered top guys, but if you go back and look at the runs, they almost really weren't.
Bret Hart's 95 consisted of this feud with Lawler, which was terrible, Hakushi, Dr. Isaac Yankum, Jean-Pierre Levite, and Bob Backlund. He's one of the best technical wrestlers, maybe the best technical wrestler of all time. And those are the feuds that you had for him in your worst year in business. And you wonder why your business was down. When you're running King Mabel at the top of the card against Diesel, who have maybe 3.5 moves between the both of them, and your top guy, your best seller, your best wrestler, overall, Wallering and feuds with Jerry Lawler 10 years past his prime, Dr. Isaac Yankum, which is just ridiculous in itself, and Bob Backlund 20 years past his prime.
Well, to me, I think this feud with Lawler could have actually worked a little bit if you let Jerry Lawler be Memphis Jerry Lawler. Because you go back and you can see some of the SWA shows from this time when Vince and Pat and Bret and them were coming down to USWA in wrestling, and you know Lawler's doing his Memphis Lawler stuff, and that type of stuff, it works really well because obviously Vince is kind of playing like the, you know, the billionaire gimmick, and Bret essentially playing a heel. But up here, no, they just turn into a fucking goofball. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why it doesn't work. I mean, the matches they could have had would probably be somewhat decent because, I mean, Lawler may not be the 80s Lawler, but he can still kind of work a little bit. But it just seemed like the writing's on the wall as far as what Bret means to the company. And I could see that's probably why Vince kind of corrected the problem a couple months down the road at Survivor Series.
I'm fine. Yeah, I would agree with the Memphis comment. But I would also agree that a Kiss My Foot match is very Memphis. Almost too much Memphis.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Why not go with, like Court said, they've been feuding for 2.5 years, essentially. Why not go with something a little bit more violent, a little bit more bloody? I know they didn't do blood in 95, but a cage match, to me, would have been very Memphis and would have fit this feud. To have this be essentially the blow-off for this feud, and it be surrounded by Jerry Lawler's gross foot, make little to no sense. And honestly, I think they picked this match. I don't know if you caught this. They were promoting some sort of Tenactin rip-off throughout this match and through Jerry Lawler's segments through the show. I honestly think they picked this so that they could have product placement with whatever bullshit OTC product they were selling.
Well, they had, like, Johnson & Johnson's fucking, like, floss, and they had, like, Crest toothpaste shit after the match, too. Like, I'm sure you're right, though, because, like, that's 95, like I said, it was such a shit year. They did everything they could to drum up business, so, like, that's why, like, you saw all those Stridex commercials and the goddamn blimp And like you said, that fucking, the tough acting, ten acting, or whatever the fuck, like all that shit.
And the build for this was not bad. I mean, their feud, as far as the segments and things that are on the show, I still remember him going into the crowd at Raw when it was at the Manhattan Center and just shitting all over Stu and Helen and just cutting all these nasty promos on Brett and his family. So, I mean, for it to resonate 20-plus years later, I mean, they were effective. And I thought he was an effective heel in this match with his usage of the boot and how he hit it from the referee and his body positioning and all that, I thought were great. But it just, the match was bad, and it was just very cartoony. And we're talking about a feud where you're going after someone's family, to have a silly gimmick match like this made little to no sense. But that's why I kind of believe it was just to try to make side money on product placement.
I agree.
What did you think of Brett kicking out of three pile drivers early on in the match?
That's something I had in my goddamn notes, because all you hear is people shit on the indies about how, oh, they're killing the pile driver. Oh, they're killing the super kick. Oh, they're killing this or killing that. Jerry goddamn Lawler hits Bret Hart with a pile driver three fucking times in, like, what were they, maybe 5 minutes into the match? And Bret kicks out. And I don't even mean like a dramatic kick out. I mean with fucking ease, like he just took a fucking back bump.
Like, what the fuck? That was like one of the most protected finishers forever in wrestling, was Jerry Lawler's pile driver. And for him to just kick out like it was nothing, I was like, I was kind of checked out at that point with this match.
Jerry Lawler had two finishers in his entire career. It was that, and it was the fist drop, which he also hits later on in the match.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, and he just shits on both of them.
Yeah, I checked out. It was very frustrating for me, being a Lawler fan, just to kind of see what they were doing with him, making him a caricature of himself. And then the goddamn foot puns between Doc Hendricks and Vince McMahon throughout this match made me want to pluck my fucking eardrums out.
You mean you didn't like the Tomain poison?
Yeah, that... And what was Vince's obsession with wanting to know if Brett's foot tasted like chicken? He asked that like 12 times. Like, what the fuck? That was fucking bizarre. And this was one of their top build matches of the night. I mean, it was really their premier singles match for this show. And it was horrible. It really was. And it was a shame. And like I said, perfect microcosm of Bret Hart's 1995. Was this match.
Yeah, I mean, and the sad thing, though, is, I guess this match was like the other one that I said, I guess, isn't terrible given what's on this fucking card. But you place this match on the other pay-per-view, and it's probably one of the worst matches of the night. And I'm amazed, though, at one thing, that Jerry Lawler is as flexible as he is, because he was able to eat his own foot.
You know... That some people would pay money to see other people do shit like that.
Yeah, you.
Jerry Lawler just with ease. No, yeah, fuck you, no.
I was going to make it.
If somebody was licking her own toes, you'd be paying.
I would not. That's gross.
I was going to make a Jerry Lawler going to jail comment, but I'll keep that to myself.
Oh, God damn it. What have we become?
A train wreck. I will admit, yeah, though, that's part of him spraying his toes and shit like that. That was just, that was gross.
Well, you know, one thing we didn't fucking mention, guys, fucking Hakushi looks like a dumbass.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
he fucks up twice.
Well, who's the dumbass? Is it Lawler or Hakushi? After Hakushi cost him the match, he came back out, and Lawler still wanted his fucking help. Like a goddamn idiot. And got blasted again. I would argue that Lawler's as big a dumbass as Hakushi is.
Well, I won't argue that.
But I will admit, though, one thing, like watching a couple of the Raws leading up to this, I think it was like the first one after the pay-per-view or whatever, Brett does come down to ringside and he starts, you know, getting after Lawler and stuff, and then they have a little thing and then they break it up. This sort of kind of showed a little bit of this, like the seeds of the Bret Hart, you know, kind of attitude that he would have down the road. And I thought that stuff was pretty good, but just a shame they didn't show more of that for this feud.
Well, I don't know. I just, like we talked about earlier, I see this and I just feel bad for Bret, but...
Yep.
I don't know. Just 95 sucked. How about that?
Speaking of sucking, the King of the Ring final is next, featuring Mabel with Mo defeating Savio Vega with Razor Ramon in 8.5 minutes. Why? Why did this happen? I mean, we kind of talked about it earlier, but to me, this would have been a perfect time to call an audible with a better babyface in place. And I mean, we may as well talk about it now. To me, if it was up to me to booking this, unless I'm forgetting, why not use the 1-2-3 kid in this place instead of Savio Vega? And have him be, he's the perpetual underdog, that's his whole goddamn gimmick. So have him be the one that goes and has 4 fucking matches, and then you have this awesome kind of spectacle between the almost 600-pound purple grape Mabel against this tiny twig 1-2-3 kid, and have them fight. And I would have had 1-2-3 kid win the whole goddamn thing, because who doesn't like a David versus Goliath win? And that would have got a pop, well, I think, in Philadelphia.
Well, the year prior, the Owen Hart 94 King of the Ring, him and Owen had that fantastic fucking match. It was only, what, like 4 or 5 minutes? But it seemed like it was like a 15-minute, you know, exhibition. Yeah, that would have made it a better sense. Or even have Shawn Michaels just go all the way fucking through.
Well, I mean, I don't know if y'all caught it, you know, because 1-2-3 Kid comes out at the end and is part of the crew that gets attacked. I think it was Vince that made a comment about his neck being hurt. I don't know if that was kayfabe or if that was legit, but they were trying to act like Kid had some kind of an injury.
Well, maybe that was the reason, but, I mean, to me, the story they told would have worked with someone that was believable in that role. Savio Vega wasn't the guy. I think Kid could have been the guy.
I agree, wholesale. I mean, shit, there's plenty of options you could have had, but I'm with you. I think that it was just, let's just throw whoever out there to do this, because the whole point of it is, I really feel like, you know, we talked about Mabel was going to be the guy. They just wanted him to beat someone that was above him. So they have Savio randomly in the mix. Then you throw in Bob Holly, you throw in the 1-2-3 Kid, and you throw in, they still have him beat the shit out of Razor at the end to really get him over as the top heel. They let him destroy all these baby faces. And I really just don't think that, honestly, don't think they gave a shit who it was, because they knew this was the plan. And in their heads, they're like, it's going to work either way. It fucking didn't. But I think that's what their idea was.
Say, imagine how this crowd would have went had Razor been in this match and made it all the way to the finals, only to lose to Mabel in the finals. I think the fans were already chanting ECW during this match. I think these fans would have just, you might have seen garbage thrown into the fucking ring.
I mean, maybe. Honestly, at the same time, maybe they wouldn't have given a shit even more, you know?
Maybe.
Yeah, that would have been far better, or Use Taker, or whoever. Any babyface would have been better than what they used. Vega was an unknown commodity to most of those people in the crowd, unless they were super hardcore tape traders and got a bunch of shit from Puerto Rico and knew who TNT was.
But even when you look at 93 and 94's King of the Ring, you have 93, you know, Brett's coming off of carrying the world title. So this is kind of essentially a makeup to Brett, and then he, you know, shows why he's one of the best. Owen Hart comes in 94. He's coming off his fantastic match against his brother at WrestleMania 10. But he's, like you said, you know, Vega didn't have that workload for the fans to buy into. And I think that's one of the things that hurts us, because, you know, with Brett and Owen, they had those prior. So the fans could get behind it, they could, you know, go, well, yeah, that makes sense that he would win the King of the Ring. Not here. Not even for Mabel. Mabel was a tag team in the tag team prior to this. So it's not like he had a big singles run prior to this either. And all he was doing was just coming in and sitting on people. It just doesn't make sense why you would give it. I mean, I get it. He's 6'7" and he's over 400 pounds, but still.
I just think it was a goddamn waste. I mean, you could have. I know we've sung his praises all day, but instead of putting this big fat guy, I mean, no disrespect to him, but he just was not that great. You could have had a believable guy who could whoop your fucking ass, like Kama, could have been pushed heavier. You could have fucking had King Kama, I think would have been a more believable heel than Mabel, who was so fucking limited.
And then to me, you look down the road. What do they do with Mabel after he loses that SummerSlam match? He really doesn't do much. And then he's out of the company and then comes back as Viscera.
Well, I don't know if that was WWE. Okay, that was all his fault because, you know, he had the feud with Diesel. Then he went straight into a program with Taker. He managed to hurt both Diesel and Taker. And so he hurts Diesel, and Vince's like, oh, God damn it. All right, well, Taker can control him. Then he hurts Taker, and he's like, fuck him. He's out. So he kind of was his own undoing. I mean, had he been safer, he maybe could have had a longer shelf life. But he was so reckless.
If the Sheath were to be believed, he was going to get fired after SummerSlam with Diesel. Vince was ready to can his ass then because of how bad the match was and how he injured Diesel.
But what was Vince expecting? I mean, Mabel had only started wrestling in 93. So he's only been at this for 2 years. So it's not like he's, you know, the solid veteran like Bret Owen or any of them guys. So to expect that he's going to, you know, be able to work safely with some of these guys is totally asinine.
I totally agree. But Vince does this shit all the time. I mean, his history is he doesn't use normal logic. He uses Vince logic, and probably for whatever reason, he thought a guy that was 2 years in the business, super green, dangerous in the ring, didn't really have control of his body, would be able to magically figure it out once he was put in front of 20,000 people. Because, you know, nerves and things don't ever play a factor in that. So, I don't get it. The whole booking logic behind this was bizarre.
Again, I say, it was fucking 95, man. What do you expect?
Mm-hmm. There was one good thing that came out of it. The ECW chants. And what kind of relationship that was formed with ECW in the years following this. I believe, personally, this kind of put ECW on the radar for Vince. He pointed out during the show that they were chanting. He thought they were chanting for Savio in the final, but they were chanting for ECW, and he becomes kind of flustered with that because they're hijacking his show. But I think he kind of begrudgingly respected that, and shortly thereafter, it wasn't too much longer after that, ECW started invading Raws and did that here and there over the next year or so, and I would imagine, I mean, I haven't watched that DVD in a while. This is right around the time where Vince started financially supporting ECW, too.
It's pretty close.
So it would not shock me if this is kind of where that stemmed from.
Yeah, it makes sense.
We did not talk about Mo fumbling through the fucking coronation of King Mabel. I think him trying to do the fucking reading out of the fucking script or whatever lasted longer than the goddamn final match did.
It did.
With the exact words from Vince McMahon being, let's get this over with.
It was dog shit, too.
Right. Anyway, go ahead. I just had to throw that in there.
So, big product placement segment with Lawler, with the bottle of mouthwash, a toothpaste. He's basically eating toothpaste and necking a bottle of mouthwash and vomiting and all that fun stuff. Anyone have any comments on this segment that kind of wrapped up the Kiss My Foot match?
Yeah, it was what it was.
No, last match, finally. The main event tag team match between Diesel and Bam Bam Bigelow defeating Tatanka and Psycho Sid with Ted DiBiase in 17 and a half minutes.
And if this goddamn main event doesn't...
And I fell asleep with 5 minutes left to go.
Go ahead, Court.
I was gonna say, if this main event doesn't scream 1995, I don't know what the fuck else does.
This is like a bad Raw main event.
It is. It's exactly what the fuck I was going to say. Like, it's so bad. It's like, okay, one, was Diesel legitimately injured?
Yeah,
okay.
I feared so.
Okay. So, let me make it a point here. So, you know, they didn't really show a big, like, a video package, but, you know, they did the promo,
and they're showing the two bad bumps that Diesel took. Man, I'm sorry, but the first goddamn thing that you learn in wrestling school or when you're getting trained is to not put your fucking arms behind your back when you fall. Like, that's his own goddamn fault. If I was Vince McMahon in 1995, I would not have fucking highlighted the fact that his bumps are terrible and he's reaching behind himself. Because legitimately, that's how the fuck you break an arm. I fall down in a goddamn grocery store, I slip on a fucking banana peel, I'm taking a bump. I'm not reaching back. That's how the fuck you hurt yourself. I got so mad when I saw that. I'm like, you dumb motherfucker. Like, at that point, he'd been wrestling for, like 6 years or something like that? Like, yeah. You should know better.
I don't really have anything to say about this match. It was just there for me. It was way, way too long. Why Tatanka is main eventing anything at this point is beyond me. I felt bad for Bam Bam, but even then, he shouldn't really have been in this match either. They would have been better off just doing Diesel and Sid and been done with it, but...
Hey, at least...
You guys have anything on this?
At least Bam Bam came out to, the Max Moon entrance or whatever with the fucking wrist cannon, and I think one of them didn't even go off properly when he was in the ring. I think it shot forward, and I think he was even a little surprised, like, oh... And that's when Vince goes, look at that. You almost killed somebody in the front row. but, no, here's my thought on, the whole million-dollar corporation. Really? Ted, you're going to go out there and you're going to spend money on... I get it. Sid, okay. Sid, he's the main eventer. But on Tatanka and King Kong Bundy, really? Tatanka hasn't been good since 93. And even that was a little skeptical.
I agree with that.
Just didn't make sense. And then, Tatanka's a heel because he's got black trunks and black face paint. Well, fucking fantastic.
That's something I fucking put on here, is that, so we got heel Tatanka, right? I get it. He's Native American, right? What the fuck ever. But, that being fucking said, man, what in the goddamn... is going on with this? He's still just dressed like a Native American. Nothing special about him. He's a heel Indian. He's not acting like... What is he, a fucking casino Indian?
That's what they're trying to do with him.
God damn it. Makes no sense.
Well, that's what my thought is. If you're going to... I know that... Somebody had a feud with somebody, because I think... Didn't Bam Bam have a feud with Tatanka or something? That's why Tatanka got thrown into this?
I think so.
Probably.
Because I was going to say, wouldn't it have made more sense to throw, King Kong Bundy in there rather than Tatanka? Because at least it's two big monsters going up against a babyface team that are essentially two big monsters.
I'm going to steal Court's gimmick. It's 1995. What do you expect?
I guess. I don't know. A part of me, though, also, too, watching Bam Bam work, made me miss... seeing, somebody of his caliber. Because for a big man, while this isn't a great interpretation of his ability, he's still a good worker, and he still can move for as big as he is. It just made me sad that there ain't nobody around that can do that type of stuff anymore like him.
Yeah. I'm with you.
So, final thoughts on the show, guys. We're finally done going through this... what I think is the worst WWE pay-per-view of all time. I can't think of one that would be worse. Any final thoughts on this?
No, the whole goddamn fucking show sucked.
Yeah, this thing really... I've gone back and watched the first In Your House, and this literally felt like 2.5 or something like that, because it's what it felt like. It did not fit... It began special, and given the caliber of the previous King of the Rings, this one was a shit show, but thank God for 96.
It wasn't that much better. It was better, but it wasn't that much better.
Well, at least I didn't have to listen to Savio cut a promo and other things and watch King Mo or... whatever, talk and shit. It's just too much.
All right, guys, so next week is our 10th episode. We somehow made it to 10 episodes. We had a poll up on the Facebook group, Ringside Chat, And we're going to do our first of hopefully many what-if scenarios. And the poll results are in, and the what was selected was what if Eric Bischoff had bought WCW. So that is what we'll be talking about next week.
Yeah, I think when you go back and you look at some of the observers and read Brian Alvarez's book, The Death of WCW, it's very interesting how that sale went down between WCW or Turner and, or AOL and WWF, because you know it seems like essentially Eric was offering more money and had everything in place, and it's just crazy to me how that all turned out and stuff. And I think too is, I mean, if you go back and you, like I said, go back and you read some of those observers and stuff, even listen to Bischoff talk, some of the ideas that he had for his version of WCW was very interesting and what he wanted to do. It almost seemed like he was really pulling from his roots in time with the AWA, so it's really interesting.
All right, guys, so we'll have that for you next week. Court, you have anything you need to plug?
Well, as always, at CM Dangerous, that's my Twitter, that's my Instagram, facebook.com/CourtMontgomeryWrestling. I try to edit that as much as possible, everybody know. Something I haven't been hyping, and I should a little better, is go on Facebook and go on Instagram, look up Midcard Guy. They're a clothing company out of California. They're one of my sponsors, and they got some great t-shirts, man. They got some hoodies and all kinds of random shit, and they're super cool guys, man. Please go check them out and buy some merch.
Joe, you got anything?
Yeah, I'm going to set up a Patreon for Court so he can go on Sonny's Glass Bottom Boat Tour. So we'll be looking for that in the coming weeks.
What the fuck?
So I'm really excited about that one. I think that one's going to be really good. We'll even throw in some like different tiers for some things that gives back to the people that donated. Maybe like an aroma candle or something like that. So I think it'll be pretty exciting.
An aroma candle.
Yeah, like it smells like her bodily odor. So I think that'll be really good, because I feel like she's right there in bed with you. So I think it'll be good.
Oh, I thought maybe it was gonna be a fart candle.
I wanted to be a little classy now. So.
Well, I didn't know you were still talking about her. I thought we were talking about me.
That's the sponsor of her Skype session, Poopery, and the Squatty Potty.
Please, hell.
All right, on that note, make sure you like us on Ringside Chat Facebook group. Search it, and it'll pop up. It's usually one of the first two that are up there. Like our page, like our Twitter, Instagram, all that other horseshit that we don't do. And we will see you next week when we talk about what if WCW survived Court's
pick. And what if Court actually took a glass bottom boat tour?
Damn it.
Yep. We may book that instead.
That's the paid episode.
And maybe a hot topic story. Right.
This is the last episode of Ringside Chat Podcast, so I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with a new podcast, hopefully a lot better than the last nine. Goodbye.